right, looks like we're ready to rock and roll. I will call the Parks and Rec Advisory Board regular session meeting to order. May we have roll call, please?
Chair Ellen Geyer?
Present.
Vice Chair Gary Temple?
Here.
Member Philip Saletta?
Here.
Member Ronald Odell?
Present.
Member Anna Clark?
Here.
Member Joseph Coyle?
Here.
And I think Charles might just be late. I hadn't heard that he was going to be absent. Okay. So.
All right. Thank you. And I don't believe we have any call to the audience cards.
Nope.
Nope. All right. Council liaison comments. Melanie?
Thank you so much for the good year of work that you've done, and I've really enjoyed serving as your council liaison this year. Councilmember Joyce Jones-Ivey is here with me tonight, and starting in January, Councilmember Jones-Ivey will be the council liaison to the Parks and Rec Board, and I know that she'll do a fabulous job, so you're all really lucky to work with her moving forward. And I'm sure Christy will have an update on the things that the council has kind of made progress on in terms of Parks and Rec, but that's about all I have. Thank you.
Right. Thank you very much. Board member reports. Anyone have anything they'd like to bring up? I will then take a minute to remind us of our Saturday outing. We are meeting not at the Linda Vista Trail, which was in an email earlier, but at something called Loma Linda Trail. But it's easier than that. At 9 o'clock, if you show up at that address that Casey gave us, 680 Calle Concordia, so from Oracle, past the high school, past the church, it's on your right, it's slightly hidden, there's the world's biggest oleander bush, apparently, in front of it. If you get to La Cañada, you've gone too far, turn around, and it'll be easier to see coming from that direction. We will pick up rubber gloves, those grabby things, I don't know what else, we might need a vest, bring your own water if you think you need it. If it's pouring rain, we'll cancel. I'll email you. So if it's pouring rain and you want to know, check your email, and I'll cancel it, and we'll redo it some other day. Does that make sense? Okay. Hope to see you all there, 9 o'clock. And if you can't make it, we'll do something horrible to you. Just kidding.
Sorry.
All right. You're ready for the regular session agenda. Item number one is review and approval of the September 17th meeting minutes. I would like to suggest a small adjustment to the way they're written. Under item two, the paragraph that follows it should follow item three. And likewise, the paragraph that follows item three should be moved down to item four. Okay, does that make sense?
Item three to item four.
I think they're just in the wrong spot. There's nothing
learning
wrong with them.
Quick.
Yeah.
All right, perfect. We'll make those changes. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you. Anyone else have any suggestions or comments? All right. Do we have a motion to approve?
Move approval with those changes.
Okay.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 The motion, the minutes are approved as adjusted. All right, item number two is a presentation regarding the Parks and Recreation Needs Assessment and Master Plan. Mike, how do you pronounce your last name?
Svets.
We need to get him up to a microphone, ma'am, or we can't hear him on the recording.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking.
You can move that. You can carry it. You can put it over there.
Oh, that might be easier.
There you go.
Or I might just sing and dance. My name is Mike Svets, with principal with Pros Consulting. I didn't know if you had a preamble or not. Nope.
Take it away.
All right. Awesome. Let me try to... I'll do my best. So... thank you very much. We are super excited to be conducting your Parks and Recreation Master Plan. I gave Rebecca Field from Kimberly Horn. They are a part of the team. She has the night off. Her parents are in from San Antonio for the week. So I thought it was best that they had some little family time. So what I wanted to do tonight was just to kind of give you an overview of the process that we're going to undertake. I think it's important to recognize that initially this project will be done in two phases based on fiscal year. So the first phase of the project is really going to be about community engagement, as well as an inventory and assessment of your parks and recreation system. The second phase will be an analysis of programs and services, the levels of service around which you provide programs and services and parks and amenities, capital improvement plans, funding strategies, recommendations. So it will kind of be broken up into a couple of different phases. So kind of without further ado, what I wanted to do is just kind of give you an understanding of how the it worked before. Technical difficulties, my apologies.
It was working.
I know. It was working just fine. It's on. Yeah, that'd be fine. Yep. Yeah. Okay. So we'll have some assistance. I'll set this down. The team is made up of, next slide, is PROS Consulting. PROS is a firm that has been in business for about 25 years. We have offices in Indianapolis and Phoenix. I am located in Phoenix. PROS is not a firm made up of landscape architects or architects or engineers. We really focus on understanding park systems from a financial perspective, a level of service perspective, an operations perspective. I myself spent 20-some years on Christie's side of the table and spent about 15 of that in executive management positions in Ohio, Virginia, and also here in Arizona. We basically do master planning work, but we do a lot of strategic planning, operations planning, cost of service work, anything that you can think about when you think about parks and recreation from an operations perspective, as well as at the end of the day providing programs and services to the community. Kimberly Horn is also a part of the team. They are, and we have done a lot of work with them. We have done a lot of work with Kimberly Horn. We have, done several master plans in Arizona with them. We're currently, obviously, teamed to do yours, but we're also teamed in process of doing Prescott Valley's as well as the city of Chandler's. They are a full discipline firm across the country. We are working with, as I mentioned, Rebecca Field out of the Tucson office. And then another key partner for us in this process is the statistically valid survey. The firm that we are working with to conduct the statistically valid survey, likely to take place in February and March of next year, is ETC Institute. They are out of Olathe, Kansas. They do statistically valid surveys across the country for two primary purposes. One is transportation. The second one is parks and recreation. We have teamed with them for almost 20 years on 400 different surveys. They alone, just in the last 10 years, have conducted 300 surveys across the country for parks and recreation needs assessments and master plans. So some influencing factors. We have kind of pulled together a demographic profile of your community as well as some recreation trends. And just wanted to share with you probably information you already know, But yet at the same time, I think informative, because it helps to frame your community, at least in terms of some demographic information related to programs and services, and then, of course, the corresponding parks and recreation amenities. So from a population perspective, you're just under about 46,000 folks. You're growing at about 1% a year, right at about the U.S. annual average. If we project out 15 years, you will grow to just about 55,000 folks over the next 15 years. Age segmentation, interestingly enough, the average, I think it's important to recognize you are in an aging community. Currently, your population, almost 49% of it is made up of the 55 and older age segment. By 2034, it will be closer to 58% of the population. This is really important because it really means that parks and recreation, in some way, shape, or form, is going to be putting a lot of its resources into providing programs and services and the corresponding parks and facilities to meet the unmet needs for a growing population of 55 and older. Ironically enough, the second largest population is really under the age of 17. They make up the second largest segment. So you're bottom heavy and you're top heavy. And I think it's important to recognize this as a foundational element in terms of where your system needs to go. We also like to look at ethnicity and race. And this is simply because ethnicity and race equals culture in many cases, and culture has a way to define parks and recreation experiences. You are primarily a white alone community, which you know. Your largest minority population is the Asian population, and that's only going to grow to about 6% by 2034. The Hispanic population, those that have Hispanic origin or Latino origin to them, they are not a standalone subset like white alone, black alone. You can be white alone and have some Hispanic origin. You can be black alone, Hispanic origin. You are currently at about 14% with regards to the Hispanic origin, and that will grow to about 19% in 15 years. So about one out of every five folks in your community will have some Hispanic origin to it. And then from an income levels perspective, you know that you're an affluent community. And we recognize that. I think the one thing that at the end of the day, Parks and Recreation is always about trying to provide high quality experiences. But there's also a business side to it. And the business side indicates that you may have opportunities to recover costs, operational costs, in particular programs and services, simply because you have a more affluent community. So taking it beyond the demographics, there is an element called tapestry segmentation, or as we like to call it, life mode. And this kind of takes the information beyond the demographics that I just showed you and starts to put it together with socioeconomic characteristics. So it's not just about who the lifestyle demography is about, but it's also about where and your local geography. The Environmental Systems Research Institute, they are the global leader in market and data regarding people and what people spend money on and what people like to do. They have categorized 67 different tapestry segments that make up the U.S. population. Next slide. So, yes, you're unique. What this shows is your top five tapestry segments make up 80%, almost 80% of your population. Those same five tapestry segments make up just under 8% of the entire U.S. population. So when we say that Oro Valley is unique, we can think about it in terms of age, and we can think about it in terms of ethnicity, and we can think about it in terms of income levels. But tapestry segmentation kind of takes that a whole different level. I asked Christy today, you know, during the kickoff meeting with staff, what's the number one car that you see driven around Oro Valley? And it's interestingly enough, and I noticed this myself, that one of the most prominent cars that you see out on the road is a Lexus SUV. And that is very much in line with the top five tapestry segments. Four of your top five tapestry segments are around your senior population. And what this simply means is that you have folks that have kind of landed in Oro Valley that live their lives very similarly to others in your community. Usually to get to 80% of your population, you need to dive into about 10 different tapestry segments. The fact that you all have basically the majority, four out of every five people fall within this category is really, really important. We have provided staff with an entire community profile that dives a little bit deeper into these tapestry segments, and we will provide that to you over the next week or so. So our process, just kind of taking a step back when we think about process, we really look at it from a community values model, and we evaluate your parks and recreation system through six different buckets. The first bucket is community needs, community priorities. Parks and recreation is expected and meant to be used by your community. And so their needs, and in particular their unmet needs, will help to drive the framework of what parks and recreation means in Oro Valley. The standards, this is how you operate your system. Do you operate it at a best practice level, operationally, maintaining it, managing it, administrating it? Levels of service, this really speaks to, based on the experiences of people you know most desire in your community, do you have enough stuff? Do you have enough best practice spaces to be able to support those experiences? So this is about right-sizing your system. Obviously, financial and revenue are about, can you financially sustain your parks and recreation system? And can you sustain it at a high level? What are the financial strategies to help implement a Parks and Recreation Master Plan and to operate a system going forward? Partnerships, government has long given up the days in which they do it themselves when it comes to parks and recreation. So looking at partnerships through three different lenses, whether it be, for example, the town and the schools, public-public, or the town and the YMCA or Boys and Girls Club, public nonprofit, or a public-private partnership. These have all different criteria to create win-win, and we want to look at the opportunities that you have in front of you to be able to implement the master plan. And then governance and organization is really about how are you organized and structured, and I'll touch on this a little bit more. But these are kind of the six different buckets that we will look to help drive recommendations that come out of the master plan. So our public input process, next slide, is really about a collaborative planning effort. So obviously at the center of it is the community. We want to create curiosity about this master plan process. We want to also be very clear about what this is about, and also in particular what it is not about. So this is not a system-wide master plan focused on solving one singular issue. It's about how do you develop a system that meets the highest priorities of your community going forward. We want to develop a process that engages the community that they are confident in. They recognize that they have been heard and that their input has been received and will be acted upon. And we want to be creative in our processes with regards to community engagement. So next slide. And we're going to use all of these buckets, whether it be focus group and stakeholder meetings, whether it be youth and teen, whether it be senior engagement strategies, public presentations, intercept surveys, which is in particular kind of getting out to your special events where people are engaging in your community. Next slide. We also have kind of, we will use, we have created, and I'll show you on the next slide or so, a website specific for this project. And it is planyourparksov.com. It's actually live right now. This presentation will be posted on that website as of the end of this meeting for your entire community to be able to view that. We can use SurveyMonkey, and when we get to the public meeting, like one, come all kind of meetings, we can use real-time polling as opposed to just capturing people's comments qualitatively. And this is an example of, this is actually a screenshot of your website, the project website. So planyourparksov.com. So the statistically valid survey, next slide please, is really something that is, the best way to say it is statistically valid, but it's also defensible in terms of being representative of your community as a whole. As I mentioned, ETC is responsible for making sure that everybody in your community from a random selection process is represented. So that is geographically as well as demographically. So all of that demographic input I showed to you previously, ETC's charge is to make sure that the survey responses match up with that demographic information. We are looking to complete about 375 surveys returned. That means that at a 95% confidence level, that means that if you did this survey 100 times, you would receive the same results 95 out of 100 times within that margin of error of about plus or minus 5%. One more. As I mentioned, that will probably go out in February and March. Ideally, we want to get it completed before spring break. We don't want to be chasing after returns after spring break, so we will look to kind of get it out on the street February and get those returns before spring break. One thing that's really important, and I think you'll recognize as we go through this process, is there's going to be a lot of information that comes out of this. So instead of trying to bring it to you halfway through or at the end, what we want to do is bring it to you in chunks. And the information will build upon itself. And so in addition to this very first meeting, we'll be back in front of you four additional times to present public key findings, technical key findings, capital improvement plan recommendations, and then, of course, a recommendation to town council for adoption of a master plan. We expect the entire process to take probably about a year, and hopefully to be back in front of you all with a final adoption of a plan or a recommendation for a final adoption of a plan at this time next year. Depending upon how the holidays break and how things go, it may end up being January of 2021. But we're committed to not just engaging you all, obviously the community as a whole, the Historic Preservation Commission, as well as Town Council along the way. One of the key components, as I mentioned, is really understanding the existing conditions of your system. So Kimley Horn's major charge with this is to do an inventory of your system as well as then an assessment of it. And this means really kind of getting an understanding of the all of the different assets. One of the things that we don't consider Parks and Recreation often is we don't consider it to be a built environment. We don't consider it to be infrastructure like we do roads or utility systems. I'll give you an example. When we did Scottsdale's master plan about 4 or 5 years ago, the value of their Parks and Recreation system at that time, not counting the land, was close to $250 million. That's a lot of public investment. And we need to translate all of this information into dollars and cents so that people understand the magnitude of the system that has been entrusted to Christy and her staff to manage and maintain and operate. The other key component, next slide, is to understand the condition of those assets. One key component that we will harp on, and you'll hear me harp on a couple of times in this presentation, but throughout, is that every asset has a life cycle to it. Nothing built lasts forever. And you can think about this in your own personal lives. You've replaced cars, you've replaced flooring, you've replaced windows, people have replaced roofs. It's the same thing when it comes to a parks and recreation system. And so understanding where all of your assets are, where that inventory is in its life cycle, has a profound impact on key recommendations that come out of the master plan. Simply because over the next 10 years, you will have a certain percentage of your assets in your system that will need to be replaced. If they're not, there's two things that impact then parks utilization. One, are those assets safe to use? And two, are they even aesthetically pleasing? And so if you have a system that is not safe and it's not aesthetically pleasing, people have a tendency to not want to use it. And so that is going to be a key component of this process. Next slide. So we're also going to do a program assessment, and we will, as I mentioned before, we will evaluate the partnership analysis and where you have partnerships now and where you potentially have partnerships opportunity to help implement the master plan. We will also do a program assessment, and so I mentioned this to staff today. Programs just like playgrounds have life cycles to them, and I always use the analogy. 5 years ago, how many yoga references did you see in commercials versus what you see today? So we have to be willing to let go of programs and services that are no longer being utilized by the public to free up resources to start to meet unmet needs and emerging trends. That's an example of something that will come out of the program assessment. Another key component of the program assessment is service classification. All programs and services are not created equal. And so this gives you a quick snapshot of how we will evaluate and classify your programs and services. The bottom pyramid is really about the essential services. And how do we define those? Those are the ones that have the broad-based community benefit. In other words, everybody in your community has an opportunity to benefit from what it is that you do as an essential service. An example would be community special events. The second tier is important category. And example of this would be swim lessons. The individual, the child, taking the swim lessons, it benefits individually from you providing that service because they learn to swim. The community benefits as a whole because by teaching more kids to swim, you have less life-saving incidents in your pools across your community. A third classification is that added value or value added. And these are the things that have individual benefit. And what this is it's a fitness program. It's a facility rental. The right side kind of gives you an understanding of how you should look to recover the costs associated with each one of those. The essential services have high level of general fund subsidy. As you get up to the top, those are the services you're looking to recover 100% of your costs. And an analogy. So we were over in the Sunset Conference Room today at the Community Center. That room can be rented out. If that room is rented out for a baby shower or a wedding shower or a bridal shower or something along those lines, should not the person who is renting it pay 100% of those costs? I'll look at it another way. Should the town subsidize somebody's private baby shower just so it can be held in the Sunset Conference Room? Probably not. Next slide. So we'll take all of this information and classify it and start to create also targeted cost recovery for each one of these kind of programs and services that you offer. Next slide. We also then will take this a step further. The key, and I know this is kind of hard to see, but the key driver is for every program participant you have, how much money are you basically handing them of taxpayer dollars to participate in that program? So, for example, if you are subsidizing somebody to take a yoga class at $20 for every time they participate in that class, you're basically handing them $20 of taxpayer dollars to say, come participate in that program. Is that the right thing to do? We want to drill this down to making sure that based on the classification of services, that you have the lowest unit cost of taxpayer dollars going to support programs and services that are in that important category. The higher taxpayer subsidy are going to be the ones that fall into that essential category. So this is going to be very paramount to developing a pricing policy for parks and recreation based on, you know, a justification of community benefit all the way up to individual benefit, so that you're using taxpayer dollars in the right way to support programs and services for the community. So all of this information starts to translate into community need. So we will end up with a ranking of programs and services, and then the corresponding parks and facility and amenities that are needed to support these experiences. This is just an example. This is not our community. We'd be way too out in front of it. But a couple of things to recognize. Your community is going to tell you what's needed. Community is going to tell us what's important. But the community is also going to tell us where they have their highest level of unmet need. So if something is important and needed, but it doesn't have a level of unmet need, it basically means that program and service, that facility and amenity is right-sized based on your population today. So we're not necessarily looking to utilize a whole lot of resources to expand those offerings. However, if something has a high unmet need but is also deemed needed and important in your community, that is where we look to try and identify the highest priorities where you invest new levels of resources. So we will dive into this, obviously, as we start to get community input back from the community through the focus group, stakeholders, community engagement, stakeholder, as well as the statistically valid survey. We will then start to translate all of this information into what we call levels of service. So that this is just a snapshot of actually what Prescott Valley is doing in its community right now. Their community is actually very similar in size to yours, approximately about 50,000. So they currently, you know, when you count the inventory in their system, and one thing to recognize is we have to count not just what the town of Oro Valley provides, but we also have to take into account what HOAs and master plan communities provide. They are not necessarily open to the public as a whole, but they do meet a specific level of need based on the population within those HOAs or master plan communities that have access to them. So we have to account for it so that we don't overstate the needs of the public parks and recreation system. So ultimately, we'll start to develop how many park acres are available to your community based on every 1,000 folks. Then, next slide, what we will do is we will utilize a number of different variables or considerations to develop a recommended level of service for you. This obviously begins, but it doesn't end, with just the community need component. We need to understand what that current level of service is. In other words, we don't want to overdevelop your park system if it's adequately meeting community needs today. The only way we would want to do that is if you are severely lacking in any one specific park classification category. We have to take into account your current inventory and its condition ratings. Is there a greater need to take care of what you already have versus expand upon what you already expand upon what it is that your system has? Opportunity to develop and to acquire and develop parkland. Land's just not popping up everywhere. And over the next 5 to 10 years, is it going to be important to buy parkland or not? And does the opportunity exist to do so within the financial constraints that the department and the town operate? We will also utilize National Recreation and Park Association guidelines. We will utilize activity participation rates. And then, of course, it needs to be rooted in financial sustainability. So ultimately, what we end up with is an understanding, and we will not just do this for park acres. We will do this for athletic fields. We will do this for ramadas. We will do this for swimming pools, splash pads, pickleball courts, tennis courts, dog parks, recreation, indoor recreation space. Ultimately, if we do nothing with your recommended levels of service, in other words, you are meeting everybody's needs based on today's population, you will still end up in 15 years with a need to expand your parks and recreation system simply because your population is going to grow by about 10,000 folks. So that's something to consider. But every time we make an adjustment to that level of service, it has an impact on how you're going to plan to expand your parks and recreation system, whether it means that you don't have enough of something today, or simply a matter of understanding that your population is going to increase over the next 15 years. We will also then, because not everybody loves numbers, we will also take this information and start to map it to understand the balance that you have related to your parks and recreation system. This is critically important, because if all of your parks are located in one specific area of the community and they're not doing a good job of providing equity, then this also is a piece of information that starts to say, where are the gaps in your system? Parks and recreation is supposed to be accessible and equitably accessible to your community. So what we will also do, though, is do this on what we would call a land use map for your community, because you can't have parks in every part of your community, because you don't necessarily have residential in every part of your community. So by doing it on a land use map, we will be able to identify those natural gaps in the system that we don't necessarily have to create strategies to try to fill. We will also then take all of this information and do a park-by-park workshop. What you're going to get out of this is you are going to get an improvement plan for every one of your parks. Some of it may just be life cycle replacement. Some of it may be opportunities to expand upon what it is that you already offer within your existing park system. And we will then provide a cost estimate associated with that. But we are also going to do site-specific master plans for those four parks. So we will take the narrative associated with the park improvement plan and the cost and create some pretty pictures for them. We recognize that there are some conceptual master plans that exist for these parks already, and the idea is to update them based on all of the information that you saw previously. So, capital improvements and financing the plan. Next slide. This is critically important. This is where we start to recognize what is realistic and implementable. By rooting your master plan in what we call total cost of ownership. So there's a cost to build something, but there's an ongoing every day, every week, every month, every year cost to manage and maintain that. And then, as I stated earlier, everything has a life cycle to it. We need to add all of that up to understand the total cost of ownership of any recommendation that we make. So to give you an analogy, buy a new car. This is probably overstating or exaggerating, but don't have enough money to change the oil in that car. How soon are you going to be life cycle replacing that car? Same thing goes with playgrounds, swimming pools, golf courses, community centers, skate parks, dog parks. The idea is to make sure that whatever you have in the ground, you have enough money in your operating budget to manage and operate those to a best practice level so that assets have the opportunity to reach their life cycle. If you don't, you're likely going to be replacing that asset, or it will start to deteriorate or become negligent or unsafe to use before the end of whatever that life cycle is. We will develop your capital improvement plan in three buckets. The first bucket is just what needs to be life cycled in your system. The key driver about life cycle replacement is that it never stops. If your system was built and everything was built all at the same time, that would be wonderful. Then you would be on the same life cycle schedule. But because assets are in different states of condition, we may be able to put together a life cycle replacement program for you for the next 5 to 10 years, but just come the 11th year doesn't mean you're done. And I use the analogy of a playground. Playground's supposed to last 15 years. So if that playground was put in the ground tomorrow, that will then be outside the life cycle of this master plan, meaning it likely wouldn't need to be replaced until about 2035. But if you have a playground that was put in 5 years ago, it will likely need to be replaced in 2030. If a playground that was put in the ground 10 years ago, it'll need to be replaced in 2025. So the whole idea is to understand that you have a life cycle replacement bucket. You also have what we call an expanded services bucket, where there are opportunities, say, to add ramadas, to add playgrounds, to add splash pads, to add dog parks, all examples within your existing system without having to buy new land to accommodate those amenities. And then the third bucket is the big picture bucket. It's the visionary bucket that basically says, you know, are you going to build new parks? Are you going to completely renovate existing parks? The reason these are really important is there's also different funding strategies for each one of these. There's not a lot of grant money out there just to do life cycle replacement, but there is grant money to potentially do bucket number two or bucket number three. So it's important to recognize that as we do these three buckets, it's also going to be tied to, next slide, the funding strategies. And we're not going to just give you a laundry list of funding strategies. We will do grant data mining that match up with the improvements recommended. And we will also look at a number of different funding strategies that we can determine whether or not they're implementable and sustainable within the framework, within the fiscal framework of the town. That's critically important because if we don't have a financial strategy to meet the capital improvement plan, then why are we going to put it in the capital improvement plan? It will end up basically creating a whole lot of, how do I say this, create a whole lot of excitement around something that may never happen. And that's not what we're about. So taking it a step further and implementing the plan, we are going to look at the operational preparedness of your department to implement the plan, the policies, the procedures, the processes that need to be in place from a foundational perspective. And we will use an accreditation process for parks and recreation agencies around which to evaluate your readiness to implement the plan. Next slide. A big drawback to implementing a plan is, do you actually have the organizational capacity to do so? Implementing a master plan requires time. It requires people. And it usually does not fit except for maybe one or two individuals' job description to implement strategy. But it takes an entire department to implement recommendations out of a master plan. As you notice, we'll end up with recommendations related to park maintenance. We'll end up with recommendations related to improving programs and services. This is going to take staff capacity. I recognize that FTEs are an important component of every council decision and every budget, but we need to figure out if you have the organizational capacity to implement the master plan. Again, just like the financial side of the equation, if operationally you can't do it, then we can't make a recommendation that isn't implementable. And then all of this will translate into what we call an action plan matrix that really takes the high-level recommendations and really gets it into a to-do list. What are all of the little things that you need to do to implement, let's say, for example, upgrading or renovating a steam pump? There's a lot of detail associated with that, and we need to include that in every action plan matrix. We also need to prioritize the projects based on community need, financial constraints, staff capacity, therefore then you can't do everything all at once that comes out of a master plan. You need to prioritize it and understand what's going to come in what year. Questions, concerns, comments, suggestions? It's a lot, which I know it's a lot, but it's also why we want to bring the information back to you, you know, in different chunks so that you have the opportunity to weigh in on it, provide feedback, questions, concerns, comments, suggestions along the way.
Open for questions. Charles.
Thanks. Quick question. What are the references that you use for the demographics for Arroyo Valley, showing that it's getting older and older?
It's ESRI. It's the Environmental Systems Research Institute. So if you Googled ESRI.com, that will come up. It'll give you an understanding. It can, I mean, ESRI is so powerful. I mean, it actually can tell you, not that everybody loves fast food, but it can tell you in your community as to whether or not your community prefers McDonald's, Burger King, or Wendy's. For example, it's that level of detail.
So with regards to this statistically valid survey, when will those results be available to the town?
Well, the hope is that we can be able to start to bring that information back to you in a complete needs assessment prioritization going probably around the first part of April, middle of April. It's really about, we want to do all of that qualitative face-to-face conversations with focus groups, stakeholders, public meetings, so that we get a better understanding of what the themes are, so that when that information is very important to providing, making sure that we ask the right questions of the community. And then it takes, once we are able to land the plane on a survey, takes a couple of weeks to get it into queue. Folks will have the opportunity to fill it in by mail. They'll have the opportunity to do it online. And usually then it takes 4 to 6 weeks to get the number of responses. It's been as quick as 3 weeks. In other communities, it's as quick as 8. In your community, we may hit that target by the middle of February. But at the end of the day, then it takes another couple of weeks to kind of collate all the results and be able to present that information to you.
Thank you.
Joe. Yeah, Madam Chair, a couple questions. You know me. you mentioned DTC is going to have the 4 target groups that were on your slide in terms of how they're going after getting the survey.
Correct.
To do as a valid.
Yes.
One of the things that you also mentioned is there's 48,000 population of Oro Valley, which I assume is permanent residents taxpaying who are under records.
Correct. I know the snowbird issue, right?
How are you going to reach out to the snowbirds who are, even if they're not paying enough in taxes, are still a valuable economy generator?
I think that the timing of putting that survey out is to recognize that you're going to have folks that are in those homes in your town in February, as opposed to them being in just June, July, and August.
I agree. And that's what I noted about the February. That's great timing.
Exactly.
But how do you reach out to them? They are not on record at times. Does ETC, have they done this before?
Yes.
You mentioned Scottsdale, which has a similar venue.
Exactly. Exactly. And we were able to really dial that in, taking into account that variable. Okay. It's kind of, I don't know how to say this, but other than to state that we make sure that if people's primary residence isn't here, it's no different than them having an opportunity to vote. Mm-hmm. And so they will in turn potentially end up having that mailed to their permanent address that gets forwarded to them here in Oro Valley.
Okay.
But I can, if you would like, I can get a more complete answer from ETC. I don't do the admin. I'm enough to be dangerous to be able to answer these questions, but it's not what I do every day. I just know that they nail the results. And I think probably the best way to say this, in countries across the U.S. in which they have done statistically valid surveys, and those statistically valid surveys have been the foundation for bond referendums for mm-hmm. communities, 80 out of the last 80 that have been based on their statistically valid surveys have resulted in approved bond referendums.
Okay.
So they're dialed in.
Okay, good. And another question, I was really pleased to look at what you had, the revenue recovery.
Yes.
There. And you also looked at your cost buckets.
Yes.
And does Pro Consulting ever look at that as a way of addressing, I'm not trying to drill down, but where you have snowbirds, maybe they should be paying 125%.
Well,
services.
And I think it comes down to really, it's not necessarily about the person, but it's about the challenge with cost recovery, and I'm going to state this very clearly, is the first part about cost recovery is knowing your costs.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to understand what your full cost of service is in order to know whether or not you're meeting a cost recovery target. As far as what we charge folks, it's going to be based on that methodology that I had provided with essential services, important services, and value services, and simply having that methodology around who's benefiting from the programs and services help to define those cost recovery goals.
And lastly, on that cost recovery buckets, it was really great that you presented, okay, here's where it is, and we're going to break it down into various kinds of, do you actually come down and say, okay, for value added, you know, here's going to be the 8 ways that we think you can recover
pricing strategies?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely. Correct. That will be a part of the initial program assessment to understand what pricing strategies you're currently using. There are usually 3 that almost every department across the country uses. One is residency versus non-residency. A second one is, do you provide group discounts or volume discounting, so to speak, for a group using a program or service? And a third one is based on whether or not people have the ability to pay. But there's dynamic pricing strategies that we need to take into consideration. And I'll use a swimming pool as an example. A swimming pool does not reach bather capacity at every hour that it's open, because there's prime time and there's non-prime time. Either having the ability to increase your price for prime or decrease your price for non-prime time to be able to maximize the utilization of your spaces and your programs and services is critically important. And so looking at those pricing strategies and where we can introduce new ones to help you meet those cost recovery goals is part of the process.
Thank you, sir.
Sure.
You know, you mentioned the importance of working with the HOAs and planned communities. I wonder if using the boards of those organizations would be a means of accessing the individuals we've been talking about.
I think Christy has mentioned, actually, today, she's mentioned that the inventory, the town has the inventory. The key component, though, is what population are they serving? So I'll give you an example. If you have one tennis court, but that tennis court is only meant to serve 10% of its population, we can't count it as one full tennis court in your system because it's only providing services for 10% of your community. Same thing with pickleball courts or swimming pools or square footage of indoor recreation center space. We need to take into account the percentage of your population that is being served so that we don't overstate what their inventory means to meeting your community's needs. Because most of that is private. Most of it is only accessible to folks that live in those HOAs or master plan communities.
I was more thinking along the lines of access to the individuals. So if you're looking for ways to send a survey to individuals who might not normally pop up because they're not permanent residents, the boards
may
be able to.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And that is, I think, part and parcel to the community engagement strategy as well. So I apologize for misunderstanding your question.
It's probably not a clear question. Philip.
Thank you, Ellen.
Sure.
How will you reach out to young families, youth, and teens to make sure you best determine their unmet needs?
I think one of the things that is important is to recognize the value of intercept surveys, because we know that your community, in particular from a special event perspective, is a come one, come all. You know, yes, there are some special events that are geared towards specific age groups and so on and so forth, but we need to make sure that we capture them as well. But I think it's important to recognize that when we do the statistically valid survey, yes, somebody 18 and older is answering those questions, but they're answering those questions based on everybody in their household. And so it's important to recognize that. Again, I go back to the ETC comment that they have to make sure that if 20% of your population is under the age of 18, that 20% of those survey results are driven by, you know, community need for kids. The other thing that's important is I showed you an overall community need. And I don't even think I've told Christy this, but ETC can do a whole bunch of what we call cross-tabulations. So the priorities for programs and services for example, families that have kids that are 0 to 10 in age are likely going to be different than the programs and services that you provide for folks 55 and up. And so it starts to help frame not just that you need to provide a plethora of programs, but almost who your specific target audience is. And then we also start to talk about target marketing for that as well. So it's almost going to be a master plan that has a very foundational business plan component to it so that you can just effectively and efficiently use taxpayer dollars and you're not just willy-nilly throwing programs and services out there because you're and expecting everybody in the community to participate in water fitness, for example.
I guess my question maybe go to both you and Christy. Is there, from a transparency standpoint, are we going to be able to link into what you're doing and the results as we go down the road via our website or?
Through the project, so just as an example, through that project website, the town will continue to promote.
Can we link onto that from our
yes,
Rural Valley
website? Absolutely. Absolutely. So every presentation that's made, including this presentation from tonight, is posted on that website. And then ideally links to video or audio associated with the presentations will be provided as well.
Everyone's had a question.
Okay, go for it.
Mike, Pros Consulting, is Leon Youngers?
Yes.
Okay, good. So my concern, back to the master plan community and the senior population.
Excuse me, Ron, can you speak into your mic?
Sorry. My concern is the master plan community that we have out of the 48,000 residents here. How do we delineate the senior population that does not live in that community? Because I would imagine the master plan community folks have a different agenda with what they want to see with public parks versus the senior population outside the master community. So how do you capture that information in the end?
One of the things that we can do, so we can take any geographical location in your community and run demographic information just like I did for your town as a whole. And that will start to give us an understanding. We can drill it down by census tract in your community. We can drill it down by a specific geographical location. And so when I made the statement that says we have to understand the population that those amenities are serving, we can also provide the demographics associated to what that population makeup is in those master plan communities or HOAs. It's really a matter of understanding where the unmet needs in the community are. And so we had a drive tour today during the rain, but we didn't go in and out of, you know, your community isn't a gated community in which you drive in and out of HOAs and you drive in and out of master plan communities. I don't know this as a percentage, but just driving around, my thinking is that you have more people that don't live in master plan communities than you do live in master plan communities. So there's always going to be this driver for public parks and recreation. We recognize that master plan communities in and of themselves are developed in such a way that you meet a quality of life and a convenience associated with that quality of life, in particular around parks and recreation. And we also recognize, I'll give you an example. Two specific examples that come out of ETC. The national benchmark for visitation of public parks and recreation in a community is 3 out of every 4 people. So there's always going to be 25% of your community that never uses a park or never uses a facility. That number for using a program and service provided by the town is 1 out of every 3 people. And so using that kind of information and interfacing it with the master plan community will give us the ability to say what percentage of your population is having their needs met almost fully, and then how do we focus on the remaining percentage of your population that needs publics and parks and recreation because they don't live in a master plan community. It's a very iterative process, but the very first step that we need to do is make sure that we have all that inventory correct and we have all of that data correct, which is actually why I'm happy that this whole first phase is going to take us up through June, because it may take us that amount of time to make sure that we get the data right. Because the last thing we want to do is overstate or understate a need based on incorrect or incomplete information.
Curveball. Does part of your asset inventory include tree and plant and canopy?
No, that we are not scoped to do. But I can tell you that I can tell you that Rebecca Field, by nature, is a landscape architect, and many of her comments in going around today were definitely looking at, for example, I think it's the park with all of the Palo Verde trees in the parking lot. Is it Jane?
Oh, yeah. The one with the aquatic center?
No, the other. River, yeah. So, for example, we were looking at that going, and my first question is gosh, who's managing and maintaining all of these trees? Because you give Palo Verde trees, for example, water, and they grow like heat weeds in between sidewalk cracks. And just the management and maintenance of that. And so I know that she will have some very specific recommendations around that, but we're not getting to a point where we're evaluating this tree and this tree and this tree. I think it's going to be more about species. And she even made the comment today that if she had her druthers, not that Palo Verde trees don't have a presence in the desert, because they do. They have inherent environmental quality to them and value to them. But if you're going to plant trees in parks, the preference would be that you actually planted mesquites versus Palo Verdes. So there will be some of that landscape that comes out of this, but we're not evaluating this tree needs to go because of the condition of it versus this tree needs to stay.
Yeah, will we inform and involve schools that we're doing this to get the word out?
I think absolutely. I mean, I think we are going to, you know, and I think the town is committed to making sure that they market. We're kind of the tools, but of course your community dives into very specific ways in which it receives information, and the town is very much dialed into that. So being able to push that information out through those preferred communication channels is critical.
All right. Thank you, Steve. I think we're all impressed by the thoroughness of your work to date, and we look forward to working with you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity. This will be one of too many times you get to see my pretty face. Thanks.
Thank you, Mike.
Oh, no, of course.
Go figure.
All right, we will move on to agenda item 3. Discussion and possible action to recommend to Mayor and Town Council that the Town of Oro Valley support an Angel of Hope garden, it says, I think statue would be the better word, in the Town of Oro Valley. At our last meeting, we had a presentation regarding the angel statues and felt it was very moving. We were all interested in thinking about it some more and had as homework to go home and look at the handout provided to us then and bring it back for conversation today. So that's where we are. Tracy is here today. If we had a further question, I'm sure she wouldn't mind answering it. So open it for discussion.
Chair, if I may, I think it's important to note that the recommendation is in the spirit of supporting this project, not necessarily in a specific park, but just supporting the project in general. And then if it's supported, then we'll take that to council for their consideration as well. And then if that's the case, then I'll certainly let Mike and his team know as we begin this process. Does it make sense in a park? Does it make sense in a different sort of public space? Thank you.
I have a few questions, and I don't know who has the answers. I think the idea is great, fantastic, very touching, but who will be in charge of funding this? Is there going to be a private funding? Is that going to be the taxpayers? What is the funding coming from?
When the presentation was made, I believe it was last meeting, the project in and of itself would be privately funded. So there would be fundraising, sweat equity, et cetera. If it is on a public piece of property, then it becomes public ownership. And then likely we would work in terms of maintenance, and I would imagine that the group probably has some strong volunteer work that would help with ensuring the maintenance of the project.
And if I want to add my kid's name for some reason, then I would have to pay for to add my kid's name, or that would be the city that would have to add, or how does that work? Just lack of knowledge.
Tracy, would you mind helping to? I need you to come up to the.
Yes.
Thank you.
I think it's on.
That white button on your right hand side. Oh, on the
left.
Right here. Yeah, it was green.
It's green. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Close. Okay. Some of the locations that I've seen before, we have capstones that will work with an engraver, and then people that come to us that have lost children that would like to put their name, their child's name up there, they will pay a set fee for the size that they get, and then that will help go back towards the maintenance of the area. You know, it'll be an ongoing project because you're not going to get everybody all at once that has lost a child. You'll have people coming forward at different times that they want to start putting things out there for their children.
Okay, so that money would come back for the maintenance.
Mm-hmm. And to help pay for the engraving, or, you know, however that works, it would, you know, you'd need to get that done. I'd have to work that out with the volunteers.
Yeah. One question before I pass, just several questions. What if, I'm just thinking different scenarios here. What if you have all the capstones already taken? Will we be able to add more around? Is it going to grow and grow and grow around, or to the top, or?
I'm hoping that it can be a location that we can have I need an architecture to work with me to have some kind of wall to where we can just continually add capstones.
So there's a way to keep adding.
To keep adding. Yeah, I don't want it to stop, because child loss is not going to stop. So I hope that it's something that we can keep working with and have the space.
If I may, I've worked in other agencies that had like a veterans memorial wall, and that as one wall, two-sided, was completely filled, then there was the construction of another wall. So the space was always intended to have growth opportunities. So I would anticipate that this would be similar.
Questions? Does anyone want Philip?
I'd like to make a motion.
Please.
Oops. I have one more question, Charles.
Yeah. Well, we can make the motion, and then you can have the question. But whatever you like.
Okay. Go ahead, Philip.
Okay. I move to recommend to Mirren Town Council that the town of Oro Valley support
an Angel of Hope Garden in Oro Valley.
Do I have a second? Moved and seconded. We now open it for discussion. Casey, you got the motion, right? Okay, yes. Charles, sorry.
I think angel is an universal language. Everybody likes angels. Do we foresee any issue, religious issue? I say, oh, my religious, I do not like angels, so they should not be put in a public space. I remember, because there was one city in the West, they were discussing about a cross, remember, in a town. And do we foresee any issue on those lines?
This is like a First Amendment legal issue, and it's something we'd have to work out at a later time. We're not going to fix it today. But those kinds of things happen all the time. It's the same as if you've got, you know, the Ten Commandments in front of a courthouse. You have to find a way to actually say, no, this is a governmental function, and I think we can get there, but this is the first I've heard of it. This wouldn't be the very first time this had been addressed by a governmental entity. I think we could handle it.
Thank you. Just to avoid issues in the future.
Yes, Philip.
Yeah, just a question for Christy. Don't we already have an angel at for Christina Taylor Green Memorial there?
We do. Yes, we do. At James Decree Park, it's called the Angel of Steadfast Love, and it was in recognition of Christina Taylor Green and the events that took place in January. Yeah.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion passes. Thank you. Moving on to item four, discussion and possible action to increase the number of regular CRAB meetings from 4 to 6 per year. Anna, I don't know if you have something you want to say since this was your thought.
I do. I've prepared a few remarks here. So, according to our town website, the Parks and Recreation Advisory Board acts in an advisory capacity to the town council in matters pertaining to parks and recreation, park design, and open space and trail use. So currently meeting 4 times a year, if we have to reschedule or if we do have to miss a meeting, we're looking at the possibility of going 6 months without a meeting. So the upcoming year 2020 with, he's gone now, the gentleman that gave us that presentation, we have a lot happening in 2020. So I can really just see the need to just meet every other month rather than every quarter. And then just something to point out, all the other boards and commissions meet monthly or bi-monthly. And so just like I said before, 2020 is really going to be a busy year for Old Valley, and so we really could use those 2 extra meetings to make sure we stay on top of things like this statistically valid survey coming, and then when we finish the master plan in 2021, to get those things implemented, we really do need to meet more often than just once a quarter.
Christy,
do
you
have
any feedback?
In the staff report that I provided, my suggestion is to keep the 4 regular meetings to have discussion of park and recreation overall, which is our typical meetings. We always have the ability to schedule a study session or a special meeting. The special meeting can be used for a specific use where action can be taken. The study session is where I would see being very useful in 2020, specifically related to the master plan and somewhat to the playground project. The beauty of a study session is there's a conversation. It's not just simply giving you information and you asking questions. It's a conversation, and it's more open-ended. The downfall with that is, though, you cannot take action. We can always, schedule a special session in between there if action is needed. As it relates to the master plan, action will be needed at the end to approve the project. Everything else will really just be updates and conversation.
In my opinion, what Christy is proposing makes us more flexible. You're not locked into meetings that you might not technically have an agenda for, and so you're creating an agenda and a meeting that may not be necessary. So if you have 4, there's lots of business that gets created and you're ready to go, and then you add to it as you need to, as issues come up, such as you pointed out will be the case in 2020.
Chair Geyer, just so you know, I sit a number of different boards and commissions in the town, and there come times when you have a static meeting date happening every month, every so many months, and what we end up having to do is publish a notification that we're not going to hold a meeting because we don't have any items.
Right.
That's something we'd like, that we try to avoid, so certain boards we have to deal with that, mostly Board of Adjustment, because if somebody's not angry, they're not going to come in and appeal. But nonetheless, it makes a lot of sense from a legal standpoint to stay flexible, set those meetings when the date is available so you can have a study session, and then if you need a special session at the end with regard to your massive, massive plan that this gentleman is putting together.
Massive.
That would be a great special session item where that one item can be talked about as much as you need.
Thank you. Thank you,
Ellen. I sort of have a suggestion that's maybe a compromise, if I could suggest that to the board and staff. What if we met every other month starting in January, but not have a summer meeting? That would only schedule really one more meeting for us, and then we would still have the opportunity to do what you're saying, Christy, is schedule any other meeting for any special item that would come up. So I think that would give us five regularly scheduled meetings plus anything that we would get. And I think it fits with councils generally not having a council meeting in summertime, one of the meetings in summertime. And I think if we lay the schedule out right, it would also avoid a December meeting. So I would like the board to consider that.
Comments? Yes, Joe.
I consider that a motion.
I was just going to say, do we have a motion?
Currently, you do not have a motion.
To clarify the months, are you talking January, March, May, September, November?
That's correct if we support that type of schedule, yes.
Chris. Sorry.
Gary. Christy, how do you feel about that?
I believe that the flexibility of a study session is going to be what you all will want, what we will want. We will want to sit down and talk about the data, talk about the intercept meetings, talk about the stakeholder meetings, and have a conversation and really dive into the details that you can do in a study session that you generally can't, or you're very limited to what you can ask in a regular meeting. So somewhat to jump ahead in the agenda, I'm sure you saw what the proposed meeting schedule is for next year. It has four, which we've traditionally done, and I've already added one in January for a study session. When we get there, I'll let you know why. But I think that the flexibility of adding the study session based on what we'll need to accomplish over the year will be more valuable to the board because if there's no need for action. If there was need for action, I'd absolutely support it needing to be in a regular meeting.
No, go ahead.
What?
Don't do you think I was going to stick my nose in? Go ahead.
Okay. I do really like what Phil has to say. One of the things that the gentleman that gave the presentation was I would really like to have a study session in April to go over those statistically valid survey that comes out. Because it seems like it's going to be something rather quickly moving, and we don't want to just let 3 months go by and we don't even get to meet and talk about it. So that's why I feel the urgency to meet every other month. And like Phil said, well, Oro Valley kind of, and Tucson as a whole, shuts down in the summer because it's so hot, everybody escapes anyway. So I do really like kind of the middle of the road with the addition of the study session set up in January be in April to kind of catch that survey.
Board members, just one more moment. If you have more regular sessions, I am going to be at all of your meetings, and when you go off topic in a regular session, I get to be the real pain that you all dislike. We're at a study session, you can have a lot freer conversation and have that inform your regular sessions better. That's where I think Christy's going. We don't want to fight. If you want to have five or six meetings, that's fine, but if you have a meeting where you adopt the minutes and go home, I don't think that's what you want either.
So why do you have more meetings?
That thought crossed my mind. I'm a proponent of the flexibility aspect, because we can hold meetings and not have the parameters that you were talking about, and I'm a big proponent of that.
But it's not that there are no parameters. There are just easier parameters.
Charles.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what is the purpose of having more meetings? It's to discuss, right, the needs. But I think if you have these formal meetings, we are sort of close what we can ask, what we can do. And these study sessions, we have more flexibility to discuss. So we may still have like our four formal meetings and two more study sessions. Then we're going to have six every other month. We have more flexibility to discuss and take actions, or at least ask questions. Is that a fair summary?
I would anticipate that we're probably going to need more than two study sessions in 2020. The study session in January needs to happen because it's related to the playground project, not the master plan project. So that's where I'm talking about flexibility in terms of we have a lot of moving parts. We also have a lot going on with the golf course and community center. And so when decisions are finalized with that, if there are things that I need to bring to you for consideration, we'll need that flexibility. But I don't know what those dates are and what those months are right now.
But you also have to consider we won't be able to make any motions during a study session. So that's something to consider.
And Joe. And I appreciate what Councilor Schlenz is about. Open meetings having been certified twice at the state level for it. However, so I see some advantages in having special sessions. However, and I do apologize to the group, I was not here at the last session. What this is bringing back is something I think Philip said the meeting before last, about wanting to have greater involvement in agenda setting. I mean, that's also something that can help, is to have prior discussion about agenda. And I believe that is allowed under open meeting.
Not on this item. You'd have to discuss that at a different meeting. Agenda setting is separate and distinct from meeting setting.
So put it on. Right.
So I understand, a great topic, maybe a good future agenda item.
It was an item that was brought up two meetings ago.
And we voted on it last meeting.
Oh, and that's where I was at. Yeah. And so that's been resolved and settled. Yes. Thank you so much.
I'm sure
it was a great decision.
If I understand things correctly, if we want to have four meetings plus study sessions, we do not need to have a motion. That's the way things are right now. So if we want to do something differently, I will entertain such a motion.
Well, I would like to make a motion to have five meetings, January, March, May, September, and November, and then with the flexibility of adding study sessions when necessary.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded that we have five meetings with specific dates that I didn't process and study sessions. Do I read the months again?
Yes. So January, March, May, September, and November.
Right. Any further discussion on this motion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Nay.
Nay.
Looks like it fails. Oh, okay.
Let's roll call.
Can we do a roll call on this?
Casey, do I do that?
No. The clerk's going to do that. Okay. One second.
Chair Geyer?
No.
Vice Chair Gary Temple?
No.
Member Philip Saletta?
Yes.
Member Ronald O'Dell?
No.
Member Anna Clark?
Yes.
Member Joseph Coyle?
Yes.
Member Charles Cachuetta?
No.
So it fails.
Failed 4-3.
I think we're finished with item 4 then, and we will move on to item 5, to review and approval of the 2020 Parks and Rec Advisory Board meeting schedule. Christy.
So it was in your agenda packet the months for the regular meetings. I did add January 21st in there for a study session. As we are working with our playground project consultant, and that's the project that's going on at Naranja Park. We want to be able to bring to you some ideas, some really super, super high-level concepts that we're considering and we're thinking through for discussion. And it, the beauty of study sessions, while you don't make a motion, you can we can come to a consensus and we can get direction from staff, and then that will help us go back to the consultant and then really be able to get in community engagement based on sort of the direction that, we want to go. So that's what we're going to do in January. The 21st is also the same day that Mike will be back in town. We're going to be doing some external stakeholder meetings. So I'll talk to him to see if there's enough information for him to come back. You know, if it's premature, then he can come to a regular meeting and simply give an update. And as we roll into the statistically valid survey, again, depending on if it's simply an update, we can put it in a regular meeting. If we need to have more conversation, then we can just add another study session.
Do I have a motion to approve the schedule as posted?
Second. I second.
Any discussion?
Well, I just think we should have that. Sorry. I'm sorry.
He was gesturing and
caused me to panic. I'm not interrupting. We're trying to figure out who the second one.
Yeah, we just wanted to see the second one.
Sorry. That's okay. And it may be called on later, but I really think that we should have that study session in April, probably around April 14th, on the agenda. Or not the agenda, but as part of our meetings.
We can call a study session whenever we want. And so I think that, what did you say? It's not precluded.
Having an additional study session would not be precluded, and I'd hate to set a study session in April and find out it's ready in May. So don't lock it up today.
Exactly.
And let the study basically mature, and then when they have enough to bring to you, then Christy can set a study session at that point.
Thank you, Ellen. Can't we set up the meeting in April and then go into a study session and then come back to the meeting if we wanted to do that, Christy?
We can, and I think that's where the flexibility is, if they're ready in April. To Joe's point, what I would not like to have happen, if they're not ready in April, maybe they're ready in March, or if it rolls a little bit later. So I just want to have that flexibility. So that way, when they're here, you're getting really, really great information to have conversations with.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, we have a motion on the floor to approve the 2020 Parks and Rec Advisory Board meeting schedule as posted. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay. It has passed. You're ready for the director's report.
So thank you. For those of you that follow us on Facebook, you probably saw a video posted last night or day before yesterday, and it's a about a 2-minute long video, and it is promoting Oro Valley's work, and specifically in partnership with the group called Dave Bang and Associates, and they are a large playground and park amenity manufacturer firm based in Mesa, and they're a big contributor to the Arizona Park and Recreation Association. This year, as one of their promotions, they asked APRA members to put together a little 2-minute fun video, and they had all these dance criterias and whatnot. And the winner will receive $15,000 worth of playground product. So we put a 2-minute, 2.5-minute video. It's on our Facebook. So if you follow, if you're on Facebook, so I'm not, so my language might be a little weird here. I might need some help. If you go to Dave Bang and Associates Facebook page, like, comment, and follow the Oro Valley video, because that'll help us in the running. So between us and Sahuarita, so we wanted that $15,000 playground project equipment to go to Naranjo Park. So that's my plug for that. We have the reminder that on December 12th is the Volunteer Appreciation Dinner at Tohono O'Toole, so be sure to RSVP if you can, or if you can't go, that's greatly appreciated. Looking forward to that. Also, on January 1st is our 6th annual Hot Cocoa 5K on New Year's Day, and we always start at 11 o'clock, and then the minute is based on the year it is. So this year it's going to be at 11:20 is our start time. And then in closing, I want to thank Casey for staffing the board and, again, introduce Maritza. She takes over. She's new to the team and has a strong municipal administrative background, and she'll be great for serving us. I also would like to thank Vice Mayor Melanie Barrett for her service to us this year. And you know, while on the board, you know, she really was passionate and supportive of the playground project at Naranjo Park, and articulated the value of that and how it translates into the value of our community. So thanking her for that. And then a big, strong welcome to Councilmember Joyce Jones Ivy. She has a nursing background and a public health and personal health background, so I think that'll be very important and influential as we continue to move forward. And then last but not least, as you all know, this is Ellen Geyer's last meeting, and this is because her term has expired. Just so you know a little bit about Ellen, she has served the town of Oro Valley very well. She was a member of the Historic Preservation Commission and co-founded the William Adler Writing Expository Program, where we solicit fourth graders in Oro Valley to write historical expository reports. And then the commission rates them, and then the winners receive financial certificates and recognition at a council meeting. And that was one of the key things that Ellen spearheaded. She was also an active member of the Your Voice, Our Future General Plan on the task force of that project. And then, of course, recently is our chair here at the board. If that weren't enough, in 2016, Ellen was recognized as our Volunteer of the Year. We've known her to be smart, always wanting to find solutions, and funny and kind. But mostly, I find her to be remarkable. Thank you.
I met Christy when she first came to work for the town of Oro Valley, and I think you all know what a gem you have in her. I'll miss you, girl. Thank you.
That concludes my report.
All right. Future agenda items. Zero. Okay, then. May I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
All right. All right. Out of here.